Thank you, Jean-François. Thank you very much for the presentation and for the invitation, of course. I'm very happy to be here. And as you said, the lecture, the talk today will be about what we call active cell nematics. You understand very quickly what this is all about. So here in this audience, I don't have to dwell on the fact that we try to see the systems we're interested in as a collectivity of individuals. So we're more interested in the swirl of this fish than in the details of each single fish, the muscles, the fin, etc., but more how the interaction between the animals, whether they are fish or birds, make them develop new structure, the emergence of these new structures at a larger scale. And so these were fish. These are starlings in the Roman sky, I believe. Not the best place to be now. And these are the cells. So these are a particular type of cells. I realize that you're going to see this movie at least three times during the talk, so you have another chance to see it. But you can see that very immediately that the movement of the cell described are collective, because you see many cells moving together. And also that after a while, the bright spots here are cell divisions, okay, all of them. So as time goes by, the cells divide, they become denser also, and eventually they will stop any motion, eventually being a few days. No, that's a conventional microscope. Yeah. Lens free microscope don't give that. Well, maybe they can, but not as nice as this one. So I define a few points here. Initially, the cells are quite sparse. You see that there is a free surface underneath. You see that there are more and more of them. And that's the confluence, the point where you don't have any free space between the cells anymore. And as I said, you can appreciate that they move together. You can see it here or there. And also that their movement slows down quite drastically over the time course of the experiment. And when you show that to biologists, the first response is, sure, this is contact inhibition of locomotion. So I give just a few words about that. Contact inhibition of locomotion, it's a consequence of cell-cell interaction and cell crowding, yet it's not very well defined. It was defined in the 50s by someone called Michael Abercrombie, who was a very respected and pioneering cell biologist. And Michael Abercrombie realized that two cells that come together and encounter, then will repel each other. I say repel with quotes, of course. We'll go their way together. And that's mediated by some signaling. When they touch, you see these proteins, ROA, RAC1, there are others, that trigger a whole network, a whole pathway of signaling that will tell the cell we don't like each other, we don't want to keep kissing, we want to go apart. And so that's typically a single cell concept. So that's the illustration by Michael Abercrombie himself. You can find these historical movies in the Wellcome Library. They're beautiful. They're old-fashioned movie taken with a real film, a real camera, not the gizmo that we have today. They were taken a long time ago, we realized, and yet they're still very nice. So these are tumor cells, doesn't matter really. And you can see on these movies, you can download them, they're beautiful. So the cells here, you follow two of them, when they touch each other, they don't like it too much, and then they separate. And you have many of them, so soon enough, they will meet another one, they don't like it either, and they separate. Okay, so that's contact inhibition of locomotion, a textbook illustration of Michael Abercrombie's concept. However, if we go back to our cells, they're called HBEX, human bronchial epithelial cells, for these particular ones. After some time, there's something wrong there, because what you expect then, when you come to confluent, is that every direction the cell turns to, it sees another cell, so it doesn't like it anymore, and everything should stay put when you reach confluence, and yet, after confluence, you see these movements. So you can extract the velocity field from these images. And you have this sort of curve where the average velocity decreases with time, as you see with your own eyes. So that's good. But more importantly, this looks like another phenomenon that's called cell jamming. And cell jamming is coming from another community, another physics community, colloids or glass transition, where not only this displacement becomes more and more reduced, the velocity decreases, but also the quantities, the characteristic quantities that goes with these flows, for instance, the number of cells that participate to this flow increases and even diverges as you approach this jamming transition. So here on this graph, you have the correlation length of the velocity plotted against the average velocity, the average speed of the cells. So basically, it's the correlation length is the extent, the number of cells participating to the movement in this collective movement you have within the monolayer. So you can measure that, and you can see that it goes from a few cells to many cells, many several 10 cells. And you have to read that plot in that direction, from because short times correspond to high speeds and long times to low speeds. So you read it from the right to the left, and you see that this length, this correlation length, increases with time. It increases with as you reduce the velocity. Okay? So that goes well. There is even an exponent here, and that goes well with a picture of jamming. Of course, cell being cells, after some time something else happens. And the cell trigger another response that they reinforce their adhesions with the substrate, they reinforce their adhesion with themselves, they change the friction mode, and that gives rise to this bell-shaped curve, but that's what happened afterwards. I'd be concentrating mostly on what on the first stage of this curve here. Okay, so we have here a very nice illustration, and I'll come back to that later, of how a single cell concept, the contact inhibition of locomotion, has developed as cell jamming, as a really collective cell behavior. And the purpose of this talk today will be to describe the dynamics and the structure of the cells in their route to this jamming transition, as they slow down and become more and more numerous because of cell division. All right, so this is the first cell type I'm going to describe. These cells are fibroblasts, NAH3T3 fibroblasts. They're elongated. You can see they're elongated. And as importantly, there is no real head and no real tail. It doesn't go anywhere. It's not a directed movement as some cells do. There is not preceded by a lamellipodium that would make a trajectory, a directed trajectory. These cells oscillate along their main axis, back and forth. This case is really extreme, but that's what they do for a certain number of hours until they don't like it anymore. And so we can place these cells on surfaces. That's what we do here. That's the initial situation. We plate the cells, they divide. Again, the bright spot described reminiscent of the cell division. And you can see that these cells grow, become smaller, that the displacement become less and less pronounced as you go on in time. And also, of course, the first thing that you notice is that they tend to align together very well. Here or there, you can see really that they tend to make so what we will call later, and I can start to use the name even now, a nematic phase. So here it's the contrast is inverted, so the bright spots are black. That's the same thing. That's so that you can appreciate the extent of alignment that these cells have in the monolayer. This sort of alignment is actually quite common. You can see it in many systems, like muscle cells, which is a little more complicated because cells differentiate, they make myotubes, etc. So the situation is a bit different, but you see the alignment very well between all these fibers. And sarcomas do that. Jean-François mentioned sarcomas a little earlier. Several tissue, liver does that too. Several tissue organized with cells packing with this nematic order, which means that they don't have any positional correlation, but they have a really orientation order. They're all oriented in the same direction. Okay, so this is the same image as you've seen before, the endpoint of this culture of 3T3 fibroblasts. And here I have coded the orientation with different colors. So a given orientation, if the color is uniform, it means that all the cells within these domains are oriented along the same direction. So this is one domain where the orientation is something here. This is another one where the orientation is closer to 90 degrees, etc. And this is the speed, this famous jamming transition that we had before, and that the orange bar is the confluence. Okay. Within these domains, so the domains coexist together, but within each of these domains, you have, as I said before, and as I can show you here more closely, a perfect orientation of the cells along a common direction. But the orientation is not macroscopic in the sense that it's not like a big centimeter square area where all the cells share the same orientation. They're well oriented within domains that we can even appreciate. They're a few hundred microns. They're very big. They're huge compared to a cell size. But they stop at some point with these domains' organization. And within each domain, they're perfectly aligned. So we can use the orientation field. Each point, each pixel is associated with an orientation. From that, we can measure a correlation function. And from that correlation function, the extent over which the cells are well oriented. In other words, the size of this domain that we evaluated about 400 microns. And if we do that cleanly like here, we see that the correlation length that we measure, the size of the domains is exactly that, 400, 500 microns. Again, half a millimeter, huge size compared to a cell size. So as time goes on, there are two effects that are antagonistic. One is it favors packing of cells together. So all these rod-like shapes, they tend to align more and more together because of excluded volume. Right, so you sort of have a pressure that pushes the cell together because you have more and more cells. So they tend to like to orient together much better. So the steric interaction makes them orient in that direction. At the same time, we enter the jamming transition. And so you have less and less movement. And so they want to align, but they can't really do it after some time because the movements are so sluggish that they would take time that they don't have to align perfectly. So that's why we end up with domains and not really with a perfectly uniform orientation all over the field of view. So this is the cartoon, not the cartoon, the image I wanted to show. You go from one domain to the green one here, to the blue one here, continuously almost everywhere. So these are the director. This is the direction of the cells at that particular point. And you can see that between domains, you have a sort of a transition where you can go directly, continuously from this domain to that domain. And same here, you can follow. Except at some points, which are here, here and there, which are real singularities. So you can see them better on this graph here. You have this singularity here. Otherwise, you go continuously from that direction to that direction. Okay? And so you have two types of singularities, and only two types. This one, which would correspond to this and that, I'm not sure it's very visible, are called the plus one half defects. And these ones are called the minus one half defects. These ones are triangle-like, and this is comet-like. And we'll see them. More and more in the next slide. Sure, go ahead.
But it's exactly like magnetic domains. It's you you have gray boundaries,
yes,
where you have defects per unit area, and maybe you have it here, but you don't need it.
But there are no real walls. That's why there's no discontinuity of walls. Okay. Okay. Absolutely.
Exactly like
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It has nothing to do with the correlation. It could be anything. It depends on history.
It depends on the history. It depends on the speed of approaching the jamming transition as well. It depends on everything.
It depends when it got frozen.
Exactly. Exactly. There might be routes by which we could make them much bigger or much smaller. Right. It's not intrinsic to the system. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Please interrupt me. I didn't say it, but please interrupt me if there is any question. So the fact that we have only these two defects and only these two defects is a further confirmation that we have a nematic phase. It's a characteristic of 2D nematic phase. But they are not just defects. Because we deal with active cells, you see them moving back and forth and doing their game. What about the flows next to these defects? So let's start from the simple one, the minus one half, the triangle one. Because of its shape, you don't expect a directed flow at the location of this defect. And indeed, you have a very weak velocity field around them. Because they have nothing, they have no direction where they would like to go to, and so there is no development of any field around them. Any velocity field. This is a plus one half. You can see the comet-like shape. And here you see an intense flow field around the defect core. Defect core would be here. You see that you have a real development of a large velocity field around them. And that's because of the activity of the cells. It's a characteristic of it. It's typical of them. And this velocity field, you can even see vertices here and there. This velocity field is directed that way, meaning that these particular cells, not all of them are like that, but these particular cells see their defect migrating from in that direction, from the blue to the red. So the defect themselves are self-propelled within the nematic phase, whereas the minus one half here are diffusive-like. So that's the characteristic of a contractile system. Can we get rid of the defects and have a completely well-organized phase? Well, we can use the same strategy as we would use with classical passive liquid crystals. We can make boundaries. So this is the greenish parts are adhesive for the cells, the reddish parts are non-adhesive for the cells. And you can see that the cells align with this boundary here. There is a boundary condition where the cells are parallel to the boundary. They align with it. And so if we plate cells in stripes, then we expect that this order will propagate to the center. And that's exactly what happened. You see that they're well oriented here. And the order propagate toward the center of the stripes until they perfectly align within the stripes. It's exactly the same strategy as we would have in our LCDs, our liquid crystal displays. You have two surfaces where we squeeze your liquid crystal, your molecular liquid crystal, and the boundary condition act to propagate across the volume which is between these two surfaces. And the order there is perfect. The order within each stripe is perfect. That the order parameter, it's just as good as it can be. Okay, that shows the same thing. You see the orientation of the cells at the edges becoming red because they align with the boundaries, and then this red color propagates toward the center until it's all reddish. All the cells are oriented in a stripe direction. The chemograph on the left shows the same thing. Of course, you cannot go forever. You cannot take any stripe. If you take it too wide, then you're back to a 2D system. You have cells that organize the memory of the boundary is lost, and cell organizing domains, just as we've seen before. They're back to a 2D monolayer. So it's interesting because of the application that this can have. It's interesting because it shows that the cell behaves as nematics, really, and also because of the applications. There is a big issue in, for instance, grafting cells, in particular in the heart after infarcts, And when you want to graft cells, you want them to be muscle cells. You want them to be already aligned, pre-aligned, because it favors a differentiation in the right direction. And so what is used usually is what is called contact guidance. We call it micro or nano contact guidance. You put nanostructures aligned in one direction, like it is here, and cells put on them orient perfectly in that direction. So it's just as good as what we have in our mesoscale system. It's completely different, however, in the concept. It's completely different in the idea, because here you address every single cell. You have a field for each cell. You put a single cell on this stripe, they would align with the stripes. While here, it's purely self-organized. It's a propagation of the order from the boundaries to the center. So it's completely different. Now, whether it makes a difference in applications or not, we don't know yet, but it might be because of the differences that the cells have been evolving into these two different systems. So we call that mesoscale contact guidance to differentiate with usual contact guidance. We've got rid of the defect in this first part. Can we take another approach and study them to get some insight about the nematic phase that we're studying in these patterns? So what we can do is study the defect rather than expel them. If we have no defect, then we have nothing left to study. And that's a defect map. Each bright spot is a low order parameter area, so it corresponds to a defect, whether plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. I don't make a difference here. And you can see that in the sequence of images, the number of defects decreases. You can recognize very well the plus 1/2 here and there and the minus 1/2 here. Number of defects decreases. How do they decrease? They decrease exactly as in passive systems. They decrease because they pairwise annihilate. And that's exactly how it looks like. This is a real image. You have a plus 1/2 defect, a minus 1/2 defect. And when they come too close, they attract each other, like an nematic liquid crystal. And they fuse, and poof, there's no more defect. They self-annihilate with the dynamics that we can study also. But that would be another story. So the number of defects decreases because of that. And so let's try to see if we can control the number of defects. We put aside the stripe geometry for now, and we take a closed geometry, like a circle, a disk, like it is here. This is adhesive, this is non-adhesive, and if we put cells in these domains, you see that they orient very well with the boundary again. And so we have this boundary condition. And then the mathematics tell us that if we have such a domain with such boundary condition, we control the total charge in the domain. It should be plus 1. And it's fairly easy to realize. You are well aligned at the border, at the edges, the boundaries, and then the order propagates, as we've seen it in stripes, and you get into trouble at the center. You need to have a plus 1 defect in the center. It's imposed by the geometry. So, for passive liquid crystals in 2D, it won't be plus 1. The defect rather splits into plus 1/2 defect that minimize the distortion energy that can be shown. If you look at that from far away, it looks like a plus 1 defect, by the way. But locally, there are two cores and two plus 1/2 defects. So let's see what will happen with the cells. We plate them into these domains here. And initially, you have many defects everywhere within the disk. And you see that you have less and less. It becomes smoother and smoother. You have one here, and you have one around here. And so the final picture is one defect here, one defect there, exactly what you expect for a passive liquid crystal. That's another way to represent it. So we can be more quantitative. We can measure things because we have many defects, so we have domains. We have hundreds of domains. We can make statistics on what happened in these domains, and that's what you have here. Each point is a defect, a plus 1/2 defect. And so if we impose the first one to be here, then the second one will be somewhere there. And so that the probability distribution function. And basically, what you obtain is that first they align along a diameter, on average. Not all of them, of course, but on average, they're along a diameter. That would be here. And also, they position themselves at a certain distance. So you have a pair of plus one half defect, and they position along a diameter at a certain distance, one from the other, facing each other. And that would be the for several hundred defects, that would be the position they would adopt for 250 microns or so for an initial disk diameter 350 microns. And if you take other sizes, you see that these position of the defect scales, that the position of the defect, it scales with the radius of the domain with a prefactor which is around 0.67. In the limited range that we can access. If we make them too big, domains too big, then we cannot see anything. Of course, they will make domains, again, same story. If we make them too small, they don't like it either. They will go 3D. They don't like that. So we have a limited domain that we can explore. But in this domain, it's fairly linear. So more surprisingly, even if we put a blebbistatin, a drug that kills activity, it doesn't affect this prefactor. And if we take another cell line, it doesn't affect either this prefactor. All the points superimpose. You have to realize that this is performed at late times. We're already almost jammed here. There is no significant movement anymore in the monolayer. It's not integrated over all the movement. You've seen that there is a trajectory of the history of the cell that they would transit from completely mobile to almost put, and that's an end image, an end result. Let's now compare it to what happened with classical passive liquid crystals. So here we turn to Jean-François and Christophe, his postdoc at the time, and we try to measure the position of the defect without active stress, that is in a passive system, with the one constant approximation and with a parallel alignment at the edges. To put a long story short, they align along a diameter. Passive system, remember. And the position at which they end up in equilibrium would be this power minus one fourth of 5, which corresponds exactly to 0.67, which is the experimental prefactor that we have in the scaling of this position of the defect compared to the radius of the domain. So the two fit beautifully together. So we can conclude from that that alpha, this slope here, is independent of activity, of the nematic elasticity, and it's really a passive case, which is surprising because we've seen that earlier that there are active flows around this defect. So how come they can go to passive? So maybe the following will help understand that. And also, these defects here are very common also in vivo. They're common in a number of situations, often involving muscles, but not only. And I like this example here from Celeste Nelson's lab in Princeton, where she studied the development, the budding of a lung that's controlled by smooth muscle cells. And of course, since the cells have to wrap around these complex shapes in 3D, they have to incorporate defects, whether one half or minus one half. And here, you can see it here also, but in the drawing, the cartoon that they make of their own experiments, they have to include a minus one half defect. And they are everywhere. Now, how important they are in the following, that we don't necessarily know. OK, let's crank up the activity of the cells. And take cells that maybe are more into the active range than the first one that we studied. So these are different cells, RPE1, that retinal pigment epithelial cell. These are myoblasts, muscle cells, undifferentiated muscle cells. And you can see immediately a huge difference. You plate them in stripes. Again, the red part is non-adhesive, and the cells are adhesive in the center part here. You put these cells in stripes, they will take a finite angle. Very definite. And they show this angle. You can see the histograms here. These are the NIH-23, the cells we had before, and they don't show any of that. So they clearly show this spontaneous tilt compared. They don't align. They align together, but they don't align in the stripe direction. Actually, they don't fully align together because there is a profile of angles between the edge here and the center that you can see here very well, right? So if there is a profile of angle, it means that the angle evolved slowly between the edge and the center. And if you have a gradient of orientation, then you expect rich dynamics. You expect flows in such geometries. But the 3T3, again, I'm not saying that they are completely immobile like soldiers in a box and not moving at all. They're fluctuating. They move along. But in average, they don't show any of the tilt that I showed before. So this is the dynamics. This is the evolution of cells from low density to high density. And if you look carefully, you see, well, first the tilt, which is here, and not as pronounced here. And you see also a movement of the cells going up on that side and down on that side. Can you see it? Yes? No? Okay. Never mind. they exhibit a shear, right, with cells going up here and down there. A real shear next to the boundaries. And this can be seen also in vivo. So this is a movie I stole from Peter Friedel. Peter is a cancer biologist. He's in the Netherlands and also in Texas. And he makes beautiful intravital imaging in mice where he implants tumor explants. So what you're going to see here is the tumor explant, which is there that you won't see, and cells escaping from it collectively along a strand because they want to invade the stroma. They want to invade the rest of the mouse. And they do that in a very confined way because they're confined by the vessel, the nerve, the myofibers. They encounter a lot of things that make them go in one direction. And that direction is linear. It will be along these directions here because in order to make this observation, Peter has to stretch the cells, the mouse skin, and so that gives a direction to the escape of the cell from the tumor. So that's what you see here. Cell escape from the tumor, and they go from the left to the right. Well, they did. I hope you fast enough. But let me show you the more interesting result for our purpose. This is just a zoom of what you just saw or didn't see. And you can see that you have cells going to the right and cells going to the left, exactly as in our experiments. Can you see that? Okay. So there are anti-parallel movements for these cells in confined geometry as they move along, and there is no reason for that. Their main mission is to go away from the tumor. There is no reason why they would go back. So that implies that there might be a physical mechanism for this two direction that the cell take. And indeed, we can measure in our in vitro experiment, which are much easier to control, we can measure the shear. This is the velocity field. This is the shear flow. In one direction on the right, one direction on the left. And if we kill the activity with blebbistatin, this time we kill all shear flows. Very, very spectacular. You don't have anything left. So it stems from cell activity, definitely. That the width dependence of the angle profile for different widths, okay? And that's, as a consequence, the angle dependence with the width in the center and at the edge. And you can see that there is a clear trend, okay? And that's still the NIH has a control, the NIH-3T3, which is very boringly staying where it is, not moving at all. OK, so how do we understand that? So for that, we went back to a rather old paper by Raphael, Jean-François, and Jacques, where the idea was to study the theoretically the behavior of actomyosin gels when you squeeze them between two plates. I don't know if the experiment has ever been done, actually. Probably not. OK. And the conclusion of, so this is the hydrodynamic equation that you have. This is the activity. That's, we had that last year, as Jean-François told us. And of course, the situation where you have a parallel alignment with the stripe and no flow is always possible. It's a solution of the theory, but it's not stable above a certain width, or because we're in 2D, so I transform the depth in width. Because you know, you can show that it's not stable. But this goes more than, so this implies that if we go to very, very small width, then we shouldn't have this instability, and we should have only the solution where the cells are immobile and don't flow. So there should be a transition which appears at a critical width of our stripes. And that's the theoretical prediction, that we should have a central angle at 90 degrees, and then it should be, it goes as a square root above the critical width. And it's apparented to a Frederick's transition, for those of you who are aware, familiar with this transition in liquid crystals. Only the control field here, the control parameter, is not an external field as in the usual Frederick's transition, it's the activity of the cells. OK, but we tested that already. We span many, many widths of stripes, and we didn't see any of this. So maybe we didn't look well enough. Let's focus on these very, very small thicknesses. So if we do that, we see this is 40 microns now. Before, we had more 500 microns. So if we look at 40 micron wide stripe, we see that the cells are all oriented in that direction, and they don't show any shear. The shear is abolished completely. And if we take other widths, then we have this nice transition with no shear and an orientation along the stripe direction, and then a transition to a shear and tilted situation. And the red lines are square root, but they could be anything. They just, what we can conclude is that they're compatible with the square root, and there is a transition, this we can say. And again, it's a Frederick's transition-like. OK, maybe I'll skip that. Oh, maybe I can. We have other effects in this system that we didn't include, that were not included in the theory, and that we didn't we can include in a revised theory. One is that there is cell proliferation. And so if there is cell proliferation, and possibly not the same proliferation rate next to the edge compared to another place here, then we expect a flow of cells from the boundaries toward the center. So the sink, the source of this phenomenon will be cell proliferation, and the sink will be a 3D, a transition to 3D that we do observe indeed in this area at late times. The other thing that we can notice, which is not in the theory either, is that we have a friction, a significant friction of the cells next to the edges, next to the boundaries. And we can see that this is the profile of the shear. The theory predicts a profile like this, pure shear. Okay. But what we have is that we have a profile that is screened by the friction. And so the significant flows are only here and there. And with a lens, which is a friction lens that is independent on the width. It's typical of the cell population. And the last point, which is even more spectacular and that is really mind-blowing, is that I've shown you several examples of tilt of the cells, all in the same direction. That's because they're all in the same direction, most of them, 90%, or maybe that's a bit optimistic, let's say 80% of the experiment show a tilt in the same direction, this one. Whereas only 20% show a tilt in that direction. So it's very, it means it's a signature of the chirality of the system, which we don't know it's coming, where it's coming from. Okay, so we can include manually these different terms in the equation. Regarding the friction, one possibility that the 3T3 that we first studied had a lower activity, but it could be also that they have a much higher friction with the surface. That would give the same result, exactly the same thing. So that's a very clear possibility, that if we tune the friction, we recover an active behavior. The transverse law, as I told you, that it triggers a transition to the third dimension. It has consequences because you have no flow here, no shear flow here in the center of the stripe, but you have this convergent flow, so that affects also the alignment of the cells at that position. And the last point is, the chirality obviously selects only one branch of this transition. The theory gives us the result that it goes only to one branch, which is natural if you have a chiral system, but also that it affects the transition itself. And here we don't have the resolution to study that in details yet, but we hope we might be able to in the future. All right, let's still crank up the activity. Let's go to another cell type, actually one we've seen before. The HBEC, remember the one that I used to demonstrate the contact inhibition, the jamming. So here they are. They move along very well. So you have no need to show that. So we can, now our eyes are more educated. We can go deeper in the analysis. Rather than just measuring the cell movements, let's measure their vorticity. Okay, so this is a vorticity map from the velocity. We can compute this very well, very easily. It's not a big deal. And red turns in one direction, blue in the other. And we can do that dynamically. And you can see that there is a rich dynamics of this vorticity, of these vertices in the field of view. They are persistent. You can follow them for some time. But they also interact one with the other, obviously. And these rich dynamics of vertices is a hallmark of what people have called low Reynolds number turbulence. So I use the term turbulence with a lot of caution. I don't want to get into a debate where, you know, turbulence is very specific. I know that I use a word that everyone is using. I'm not sure it's really turbulence. Let's put it that way. But you can see, you know, vertices, rich dynamics of vertices, hallmarks of turbulence, in systems with bacteria, in systems with microtubule and kinesin, if you remember Frances Sagas' seminar last year. And they look very much alike what we have in our system. So here we turn to a collaborator, Luca Giomi, who is in Leiden, a friend of collaborator. And Luca said, OK, we can go back to the basic equation of the system and try to solve them numerically. So here you have the equation. You can recognize the alignment tensor somewhere here, the material properties, where are they? Here and there and there, and the strain rate tensor, the vorticity tensor, the stress tensor. Activity is here. The stress tensor has an elastic activity, no non-active part, and an active stress. And the molecular tensor is basically reflect the elasticity of the pneumatic phase. So Luca can solve that, can make simulation to solve this equation and measure and calculate the vorticity he expects in the regime where the characteristic active length, which is this length, that these are the Frank constant of the pneumatic phase. This is the activity. So the square root of this ratio is a length, and it's expected to be chaotic if L is smaller than the system size, is much smaller than the system size. But he can make several predictions from this simulation. From measuring the number of vertices, their size, the mean vorticity per vortex, the energy, I said kinetic, but it's a kinetic energy per mass, so okay, so it's an energy, the entropy. Entropy is just the equivalent of the energy but computed on the vorticity. And for that, you have to use another field, which is the Okubo-Weiss field. I'm not going into the details, it allows to measure all these quantities. So the first thing that Luca did, he measured the distribution of the area of the vertices. And he found that these distributions for different activities are purely exponential. They're textbook exponential. And he has an argument for that that I don't want to dwell on here. But you can have a look at his paper. It's a very nice paper. And the other thing is that the vorticity per vortex is constant, doesn't depend on the area of the vertices. It's completely flat. So it means that if you have a larger activity, you move from blue to black, you have, from black to blue, yeah, that's better. You have smaller and faster vertices. Okay, let's go, so you can be more quantitative and indeed verify that the case. And so you see that the characteristic area of the vertices goes linearly with the active length, which is the square root of the pneumatic constant over the activity. And so the area you expect it to be this length at the squared. Okay? And the vorticity goes linearly with the activity for various Frank constants. And here, by a balance between vorticity and viscous dissipation, you expect it to be of that form. Okay, what about our experiments? So we can measure the velocity field, get the vorticity field, analyze it with the Okubo-Weiss strategy. This is a strategy used usually for oceanic circulation, atmospheric circulation. It's very well suited to turbulence. And so if we do that, where we realize first that the distribution of the vertices, of the areas of the vertices, is purely exponential, very nicely so. And so also that the vorticity per vortex doesn't depend much on the area of the vertices. It shows a small deviation, but not much. So that's a sign of a turbulence, at least how it's defined in these papers, in the system, low Reynolds number of turbulence. Now, if we do play the same game, these were integrated all over the time course of our experiment. If we now measure it for different times along the experiment, you get these different curves here and there. And of course, you have more noise because you don't integrate as much. But what you realize is that there is no evolution in time of these quantities. So that means that neither the activity or the elastic constant vary with time. They're all constant. So we can now identify this characteristic area with L square, as in the model, and that we find 50 microns or so. And okay. Now let's go back. These were experiments. Let's go back to the simulations. If we measure in the simulation the entropy as a function of activity or the energy as a function of activity, we find that the first one is quadratic with the activity and the second one is linear with the activity. This is not obvious at all. You would have expected, and in some regimes it goes quadratically, but in this chaotic regime it's linear with the activity. And so you expect the ratio of energy to entropy to scale as L squared. This active length also, again. What about our experiments? So this is the entropy, this is the energy, is plotted against time. You can see that they decrease over many orders of magnitude with time. We enter jamming, okay? And if you take the entropy, for instance, with this, it should be of the order of this constant vorticity per vortex squared. We have the prediction from the theory here. And so if the activity is kept constant, it means that as we approach jamming, we have an increase of viscosity a huge increase in viscosity, because even if it's a square root, then you have many decades here, at least a factor of 10. So we go, it really fits very well into the jamming image that we have of these systems. And if you plot entropy versus energy, so Carles and Victor tried to find two regimes, but basically it's sort of linear, and it gives you a length which is, again, of the order of 50 microns, the length you expect for these systems. So it fits very well with what we expect. OK, I end up with the defects. This is a map of the defects, still of the same system, experimental map. You can see that they move along very, very actively, if I can say. And also, if you try to follow one of them, I know it's hard because it's fast, they disappear and they reappear periodically. Not periodically, every so often. And that's because you have creation and annihilation of these defects all the time. It's very different from what we had before, where the system were more quiet and we had almost no creation. Here, the number of defects remains roughly constant, and that's due to almost the same rate of creation and annihilation of the defects. So as many defects are created and annihilated. Now let's look at the displacement, the position of the defect, plus 1/2, minus 1/2. We can identify them in the experiment and then measure, track them, measure the trajectories. And we see that surprisingly, both of them show a diffusive behavior. Remember, the plus 1/2 defect, they should show a directed movement, not a diffusive one. And here, to the resolution that we have, which is limited, but we don't have this ballistic movement. And even though if you plot the flow field with respect to the axis of the defect, you see it's very well oriented. Whereas here, for minus 1/2 defect, it's triangular as you expect, so it doesn't go anywhere. So how come you have such end result? Well, that's because of the vertices that are created by the defect. So the defect creates vertices, but these vertices are close to other defects that transport them. And so even though the flow field would be that direction, the defect itself turns and rotates and is taken by the vertices. And so you have the defect here, the two vertices that I showed you before, right? And the whole thing is transported by other by this defect and other defects. And that's why everything is chaotic in a way. It comes to a chaotic mixing. By the way, the vorticity field for the experiment and the theory are exactly very similar. OK, so I come to the end of this. We have demonstrated for for non-very active system, mesoscale contact guidance. They behave as passive liquid crystal. That if you take an endpoint very far in the experiment, everything is very quiet. You end up into the jam state, and everything is screened out by friction. So everything behaves as passive system as well. If you go to more active systems or less friction, you have a spontaneous shear transition, a Frederick's transition. And if you put numbers in it, you realize that that's the kind of transition you should have for many, many cell types. It's not a very particular point of the phase diagram. It's very, all the parameters are very common to many cells. And finally, that you can have turbulent flows, chaotic dynamics, and the transition to jamming by the increase of the viscosity. Now, what's the physiological function of all that? Well, of course, I'm not sure. I don't know. What we see here is that eventually, at late times, when all these interactions have time to develop, and you are entering the jam state, everything is kept quiet. And that's probably the way the cell wants to function when life is good around them, when everything is fine, because they have no reason to go around when there is no threat from the exterior. However, they have to be able to respond to a perturbation, whether a wound or cancer or an inflammation or something. They have to be right away. So they have to be active and be ready to develop this activity upon a perturbation in the system. That's how we see it. And so I've shown you that we can have a variety of behaviors from passive like to turbulent flows for living cells that are not that different, that are mammalian cells anyway and behaving somewhere. But that you can go from one regime to the other by either time or developing friction or developing other interactions. Okay, with that I'm ending here. I want to thank Guillaume Duclos, Victoria Shunsky also, who performed many of these all of these experiments, the present members of the group who are here, and also our collaborators, Jean-François, of course, Jacques, Carles Blanche-Mercader, and Christophe Allen-Kemper, and Luca Giomi in Leiden. And I thank you very much for your attention.